Welcome everybody to our afternoon presentations. And it's my pleasure to, we're gonna start us off with Evelyn Torres from Queen Mary University London, who will tell us about quantum gravity and the Riemann geometry of the fuzzy sphere. Take it away.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. So thank you very much for allowing me to be here. So today, I wanna talk about the quantum gravity and Riemannian geometry on the fuzzy sphere, which is a joint work with the professor Sean Majid. And I wanna just give a brief understanding of what I think about the quantum gravity. For this, is I wanna think about the quantum space-time hypothesis, which is thinking about the space-time not as a continuum, but thinking the space-time more about as a non-commutative coordinate algebra. This means that the entries x, y, z, z do not fully commute. The point with this is, after this hypothesis, what we want or what we should have is having our quantum gravity hypothesis, it should generate some quantum geometry. And therefore, we should recover the classic general relativity. So that's the goal or the main goal with this hypothesis. And if we notice, the usual way that we think about this is with the geometry aspect, thinking about the topological space, differential manifold, Riemannian structure. But if we think about this non-commutative coordinate algebra, we can think this as in the algebraic aspect, which means that instead of thinking about the topological space, we can think this as a coordinate algebra. The same with the differential manifold. We can think this as differential graded algebra, which I haven't said what is it, but I will do. And finally, the Riemannian structure is basically composed by the metric, in this case, non-commutative metric, and special type of connections and so on. So this is the main idea that I want to cover in this. And if I go with more detail about this, the classical Riemannian geometry has these elements, which are the spaces that we can think these as commutative algebras, if we want, that satisfies these this relation. And we can think the differential as a set of one forms, the space of one forms. And we'll know that in the classical way, these do commute and satisfies, of course, the Leibniz rule. But we also have this another structure added in here, which is the exterior product that is that has also a relation that is the Leibniz rule in the graded version. But what I want this is trying to recover this from the quantum Riemannian geometry side. And for this, what I want to ask is, instead of having these spaces looked as commutative algebras, I'm going to ask for a unital algebra over some field. The point here is, if you notice, everything is very similar. In this case, the one forms in the quantum Riemannian geometry side, or in the quantum side, I want to look this as a bimodule. I want to satisfy the Leibniz rule. And if you notice, the Leibniz rule is what is needed to create or to expand or generate the one forms. So that is very relevant. And together with these three star points, I'm going to ask this quantum version to satisfy the, to be a DGA, to be graded, in order to recover the first point in the classical part. Notice that also this, if it satisfies all of these terms, I'm gonna say that I have a first order differential calculus, which is what I'm going to work from here to the end of the talk. Now, after I have this, I can ask myself about if I have the AD1 forms as the first order differential calculus, I can think about the quantum Riemannian geometry in this part. This means that I'm going to propose to have a metric that satisfies to have an inverse. And if it has, this inverse is going to be a bimodule linear product. So I'm going to have the structure of an linear product in my quantum version. And if it satisfies that it has this inverse, I'm going to say this quantum, and as a consequence, I have that this is central, so it commutes. So I have a commutativity here, which is useful. I have a version from the left and right side of the connections. But the relevant part of all of this is I have my own structure or my own version of this Riemannian geometry with a quantum version. And in my case, or in my case for the Fossi sphere, I have this in this right side, the structure that I want to ask about the Fossi sphere. I'm having a lambda p constant, which is going to be the Planck scale. And it's going to give me these relations in order to construct all the elements of the quantum Riemannian geometry, which is in the left-hand side of the slide, which if you notice, it's not that relevant or it's not that that hard to compute because it looks very similar because of the tensorial part of the of the quantum Riemannian geometry. I have too many questions that I cannot cover, but the point of this is I can recover quantum gravity in here, but because I have my vectors looked as this way, 1 minus lambda p, with lambda p the Planck scale, I can think this as an Euclidean quantum gravity, and therefore I can recover more information. And that's what I wanted to say. So I cannot say too much about it because of the time, but the relevant thing about this is I can get a unique quantum Levitsch connection, which is not usually in the quantum part. I can recover this this in functional integral approach for the quantum gravity. And the relevant part is I can have a cutoff to regulate the difference of this. And that's it, I guess. Thank you for listening to me.
Questions? Questions, yes. For Evelyn. Anne, yes. Anne, you'll have to unmute yourself.
Sorry, thank you for your talk. So in terms of symmetry, yes, you showed us an equation, commutation relations there. I mean, what's the correspondence with the classical general relativity?
Which part? You mean the basis xi, xj?
Yeah, well, I was thinking more of, you know, the Einstein equations have certain symmetries, yes? I mean, you have, there's Lorentz or whatever symmetry there. So what would be the corresponding symmetries in your discretized version?
So far, so what I can say about the symmetries of this, I have a term of lambda p in my Fossi sphere. Mm-hmm. And if I go, or if I run this lambda p to zero, I do recover the basic relations that we know in the Riemannian geometry as usual. So, which is the sum of the xj square equals to one. So, I don't know if that helps. I don't know, because more about symmetry, I haven't worked more about that part. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that. So I don't know. I'm curious
because I saw something about SU2 at some point as well. So if in one of your slides, yes, you had SU2 at some point, didn't you? Divided by a relation.
Yeah, the Casimir relation. So I state some relation using the Planck scale with my SU2. And mm-hmm. This is the relation that is going to allow me to describe the basis of the one forms. And with this relation, this is going to define practically all the elements, the xi, the si, and of course the differential, the tensors, and the connections, and so on. But I don't have explicitly an answer for how it looks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions or comments?
Hi, Evelyn. Thanks for nice talking.
Hi.
I was just wondering, you wrote down the functional integral. What was it taken over? Because then you had the formal functional integral, and then it appeared as some integral over some lambda i's, which I which I couldn't quite follow.
So yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't have enough time to.
It's not all geometries or some subset or.
No, I'm thinking. So I'm in this case, I'm thinking about my metric as a diagonal, and in diagonal part I have lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, so that's why there I have some lambdas, and I'm thinking this as a positive in the Clevelandized part. This means that everything on here is positive, and I'm thinking for the Lebesgue measure as all of these matrices that has this positive part. And this is what I use to trying to construct the integral approach of that. So it has several steps. I don't know how to.
Yeah, but I mean, the lambdas there were no longer, they didn't have any more space-time dependence. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that's interesting about this.
But you ended up with a much simpler object in a way, or what?
Yes. I have for this Fossi sphere that if my quantum Lebesgue connection ends being unique and even constant for the selection that we have. And I recovered like very simple results from this. And it is very interesting because it's the quantum version. So usually it gets more complicated, but yeah, that's it.
Okay, but still it's a set of geometries that correspond what, to approximate spheres, or how can I think of them? I mean, it's not arbitrary geometry.
No. No, it's in this case for this integral, it's only for the Fossi sphere, or I don't understand maybe the question. So arbitrary, do you mean the?
In a gravitational particle, you integrate over all metrics, maybe subject to a fixed topology or some boundary conditions. But
no, so in this case, I'm thinking about integration, but I'm just thinking about the matrices by 3x3 with the diagonal having some lambda positive, just in this case. So that's my only approach. And this is to recover because of the form of the Fossi sphere of the x squared equals 1 minus lambda p, which is implicates at some point that I have an Euclidenized quantum gravity. So that is the reason why I have that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks to you.
So thank you for the wonderful talk. And there will, of course, people should, you know, discuss on Slack and in the future, Lemos and so on. Our next speaker is Eiland Carlson from Technical University Munich.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a very brief snapshot into so-called fully extended topological field theories. As mentioned, my name is Eiland Carlson. I'm a PhD at TUM, and also thanks to the organizers for letting me speak. And I guess this is more of a mathematical talk compared to what we have seen, but I'm going to try to at least start a little bit slow. So maybe if you've heard anyone mention a TFT before, it would be something like a symmetric monoidal functor, often denoted by this set, out of a Bordism category and maybe into the category of vector spaces. And pictures that might appear in the setting are circles, I mean, for two-dimensional things. And then you have this pair of pans, which you should read as a morphism going from disjoint union of two circles into this one circle, so from bottom to top. And now, of course, we want to make life a little bit harder. So I've written here fully extended, meaning that we need a little bit more. So I just didn't want to flash it right away. But so again, I'm considering symmetric monoidal functor out of this category of Bordisms and into a specific target, which is the so-called higher Merida category. So let's just start with a few more words on this category of Bordisms. So I have hidden a little bit things here. So for objects, I want zero manifolds. So basically finite disjoint unions of points. And then for morphisms, we talk about having Bordisms between objects. So for example, just a line being the identity morphism from a point to a point. And then you can have, for example, a cup being a morphism from two points into the empty set, or the cap going the other way, so empty set into two points. And then the circle also fits here as a morphism going from the empty set to the empty set. And then there's a way of continuing this for higher dimensional manifolds. So here I've drawn out one example, which you think of as a bordism between bordisms, between objects. So you read it from bottom to top. And so it goes from two identity morphisms into this cup and cap after each other. Then in a similar fashion, that's how we understand the pair of pants. And then there's of course a way of being like formally precise and continuing this, but whenever I say bordisms, these are kind of the pictures you can have in mind. And then let's turn to the target. So specifically like what I'm working on, it actually involves only the target. So this is kind of the piece that gets me excited. And very briefly, this is what it is. Don't expect you to like take it all in right away, but feel free to come to my poster session if you want to discuss it more. So objects will be so-called EN algebras. I don't really expect you to know what that is. So I'm gonna give you a few short examples. So for example, in vector spaces, an E1 algebra will be an associative algebra. An E2 algebra will be a commutative algebra. So you somehow have more structure for adding on or have higher N. Or I could simply say that these are the local observables for my TFT. Yes, and I say that I want to consider TFTs, which are technically speaking, these symmetric monodal functors. But I also say that I'm mostly interested in the target category, which seems a little bit odd. So there's a reason for this, namely the cobordism hypothesis, which tells you that there's an equivalence between, so basically a d-dimensional TFT and something called dedualizable objects in your target category. And you can think of this as being a finiteness condition that somehow generalizes that of a vector space having a dual in a strong sense. And a little bit scared of saying like, this is somehow of a locality statement after this discussion section we had today, but I'll leave it at that. And more specifically, what I'm doing, what I'm interested in or working with is one particular like condition that gives you N plus one dualizability. So I'm just gonna write it out or spell it out. So an EN algebra will be N plus one dualizable if and only if it's dualizable over the so-called factorization homologies, which are spelled out here. You probably don't have time to digest it. Think of it as a condition. And I'm gonna flash you a picture of the kind of geometric arguments that show up whenever you work with this. So on the right-hand side, this is somehow the picture you would get from looking at this statement or this conjecture, whereas the picture I have on the left-hand side comes up when you work with this higher Morita category. And you see that there's, at least if you stare a little bit at it and the framings, there's a homotopy between them. And that's kind of a good thing. So last famous words, why would I care? Because of the cobordism hypothesis that this would give me higher dimensional TFTs. And also it's a condition you would need for invertibility, which would give invertible TFTs, which are also interesting. And I think that's my time.
Wonderful. Yeah. Questions for Island? And of course we should applaud.
Don't even have time for that, right?
Okay, so I have a question. Do you expect, you mentioned invertibility. What is the statement, if all I cared about was showing invertibility, is there a similar?
So there's also a conjecture by, authors here plus Safano, you would need basically this, plus an equivalence between kind of the center, involving the center of this EN algebra that appears. Okay. But, And they claim that this should be easier to prove, but I'm not sure. I mean, either way, you would need kind of this result as a stepping stone. So.
Okay, very nice.
Okay.
What are the initials at the bottom of your last slide? TV, RT, and CY?
So Tura and Viro, Khoshketik and Turav and Cranietter. I mean, those are TFCs that people care about.
Okay.
And somehow, I mean, we've seen the Tura Viro in Catherine's talk yesterday, for example. Didn't really have time to elaborate, but yeah, good question.
No. I was just curious.
Yeah. I don't know if I should say more. You probably shouldn't.
We will have wonderful times because Ellen is also giving a poster on Thursday, so there'll be plenty of time to learn more about her work. Our next speaker is Roberta Seppi from SDU, if you're here.
Okay, so first of all, I would like to start thanking all of you for being here and the organizer, of course, for giving me the possibility of presenting you my late result. And in this short talk, I will convince you that non-commutative geometry can be a really interesting mathematical framework for speaking about gauge theories and the BV formalism. So first of all, why non-commutative geometry? So let's say that if we are interested about a mathematical formalization of physics, back in the time, let's say, or the more classical level, we ended up having two big pictures in mind. So if we are interested in about gravity, we know that we are describing the curvature of the space-time, so something that is continuous in nature. And the mathematical framework used in this case is the one of differential geometry, so something that is commutative. On the other hand, if we are looking about fundamental interactions, we know that they are mediated by particles, so something discrete, and the framework would be the one of self-adjoint operators and Hilbert spaces, so something indeed that has to deal with non-commutativity. So here is where, indeed, back in the time, non-commutative geometry enters, and it has the goal of trying to provide a unifying background for describing these two pictures. And the main idea to face that was to actually translate a geometrical object into algebraic terms. So let's try to say what means when we speak about topology, for example. So in this case, what we have is the Gelfand-Neigmeier theorem that says that there is an equivalence of categories between locally compact Hausdorff spaces on one side, and on the other side, a completely algebraic term, so commutative sister algebras. And so the idea is that something that is actually, I mean, let's say classical topologies can be somehow translated in algebraic terms. And during this translation, we get something that is actually commutative. Of course, once we are on the side of algebra, the commutativity is a great property, but it's not really needed. So we can ask ourselves what means to consider non-commutative sister algebras, which is, of course, a completely natural algebraic question. And we can somehow think about this object as some kind of non-commutative topological spaces. And of course, we can enrich this picture and speak about metric aspect. In this case, we do have the reconstruction theorem that indeed does a similar thing. So there is again a correspondence between, on one side, compact Riemannian spin manifold, so a key object in differential geometry, and on the other side, something that is again just algebraic. And once again, we can repeat the same question and see what happens if we do end up considering something that is non-commutative. And in this case, we are speaking about indeed non-commutative spectral triples that can be viewed as some kind of non-commutative manifold. But of course, as I said, it's just an algebraic object. So we lose completely the geometrical descriptions and unfortunately, no cool pictures in this case. But why do we care? So the idea is that each time you're given a spectral triple, so an algebra with an Hilbert space and a self-adjoint operator, you can construct a gauge theory, configuration space, action function, and gauge group. So somehow we do have the key object in non-commutative geometry as encoded in itself physics, or let's say a gauge theory. Natural question is an interesting one. And the answer is yes, of course. Actually, we do have interesting physical theories that can be described in terms of spectral triples. So the full standard model actually can be described in this language as a product where we do have a part given by a canonical spectral triple, so which is constructed starting from a Riemannian manifold. And this is the part that will take care of the gravity of the model. And on the other side, so you should imagine, let's say this this manifold, and on top of each point in this manifold, you have a finite part. And this finite contribution is the one taking care of the particle content of the theory. Okay, so this is for non-commutative geometry. Let me tell you something for the BV construction. So this construction actually was first discovered in the context of quantization of gauge theory via the path integral approach. So we know that when we write a path integral, it's less innocuous than what it looked like, because of course there is a problem with the measure that often is not well-defined. So the classical way to overcome this problem is by a perturbative approach. And this allows us to go from having to deal with an integral to considering a sum taken on the critical points of the action functional. But when we consider gauge theory, we do have that these critical points, they don't appear isolated as we would like them to be, but they do appear in orbits due to the presence indeed of this gauge invariance. And here is where the Gauss fields enter the game. So physically, of course, these are not existing particles, but from a mathematical point of view, we can describe them as auxiliary variables. The idea is that to use these auxiliary variables to extend our initial pair of configuration space and action functional to an extended one. So namely, we want to use these Gauss fields to be able to introduce new element, new terms in the action functional so that we can get rid of this redundancy due to the presence of the gauge group. Interesting in this construction is that physical property of the theory can be described in geometrical terms. For example, an observable is just a cocycle in the BRST complex. And here is the old construction going from introducing Gauss fields to define the BRST complex. Let me finish with the questions. So can we actually use non-commutative geometry to describe the BV construction? So the answer is yes. Actually, the result of my project was to be able to lift somehow the BV construction from the gauge theory level to the world of non-commutative geometry and to give some kind of geometrical description of this construction in terms of spectral triples. So that was the result. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for the wonderful talk. Anne has a question. I messed you up, Anne. You unmute yourself again. Sorry, that was my fault.
I wanted to clap for Berta. I didn't have a specific question. Thanks.
Renata has a question.
Yeah, a question that came up in some other context. So, you know, for the cohomology, does an interesting interpretation emerge for the higher?
Oh, that's a great question. So, actually, I think that a way of looking to the higher cohomology. So of course, as I said, so zero cohomology are the observable. And so higher cohomology groups are actually detecting whether it's possible to start from the solution, so to start from a solution of the classical master equation to get that as the solution for the quantum cohomology, quantum master equation. So here, what I presented is the classical BV construction. And in this case, you do construct an extended action so that it solves this classical master equation. And this is what it defined you the BRST cohomology.
But no, when sorry for interrupting you. I meant it now more the non-commutative part, because that's a new, aspect of your construction. Does that give any new insights? Because it's, of course, already algebraic in a sense.
What I found was how to rewrite the BRST cohomology as Hochschild cohomology. But I mean, yes, so for now it's just this relating these two cohomologies together. So I don't know whether on that side, on the non-commutative geometry side, there is more to come out. So for now I just found how to relate to these two, but okay. Construction on that side need to be, of course, analyzed. Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry.
Um, So let's thank Roberta again for the wonderful talk. And sorry to have to keep us moving on. Our next speaker is Mahum Ghaffar from Memorial University in Newfoundland.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to present my work. So today I'm going to talk about Moyler scattering and vacuum polarization calculations using the MSBAR scheme. And here is a small overview of my talk. So first of all, I will discuss the Moyler pre-level parity violating asymmetry calculations, and then the kinematical dependence of that parity violating asymmetry. Then I will talk about vacuum polarization calculations using Pollorino Wellman decomposition technique. And finally, the renormalization of that vacuum polarization using the MSBAR scheme, and then our future goals. So the first question which comes into your mind will be, what is Moyler scattering? So this is basically a simple electron-electron scattering into two pair of electrons. And it is a very clean process with well non-initial energy and extremely suppressed backgrounds. So in experiments, of course, we do not have a single electron-electron pair. So what we have is a longitudinally polarized electron beam, which is made to strike on an unpolarized electrons of liquid hydrogen target. And then finally, they measure the weak angle, theta W, which becomes energy dependent at higher order loops. So that is the three-level Moyler scattering. As you can see, we have two incoming electrons, which are scattered to the other two outgoing electrons. And there are basically four diagrams. So in two diagrams, there is the photon as a mediator, while in the other two diagrams, there is weak Z boson as a mediator. So we have these Feynman diagrams. We can apply the Feynman rules and can be able to get the scattering amplitudes. So here ML and MR are the scattering amplitudes. ML is the case when we have one of the initial electron left polarized, and MR is the amplitude when we consider one of the initial electron to be right polarized. And here is our parity violating asymmetry formula. So we substitute these scattering amplitudes in this formula, and then combining all the ingredients, we get our final result for parity violating asymmetry, which we can see is proportional to the electroweak charge. So at three level, the electroweak charge is a constant quantity, and it is equals to 1 minus 4 sine square theta W. Theta W is the Weinberg mixing angle, or you can say it's the weak mixing angle. However, when you include the higher order loops, like one loop, two loop, etc., you will see that this electroweak charge does not remain constant, but it becomes energy dependent at which your measurement is carried out. So in other words, you can say that the electroweak charge or that Weinberg mixing angle runs. So if you want to get more precise results, of course, we need to add the higher order loop terms in our tree level terms. And as a first step, I calculated the one loop level running of electric charge by considering the vacuum polarization diagram. So here, this is the one loop level photon vacuum polarization diagram. So in the loops, you can see we have either electron loop, muon loop, tau loop, or even we can have the quark loops. So again, we have Feynman diagrams. Using Feynman rules, we can be able to calculate the amplitude. And here these B mu, B mu nu, et cetera, these are the Pollorino-Wellman functions. So we substitute these functions in our expression. And using the Mathematica X package, we can be able to find the value of these Pollorino-Wellman functions. We put them. And here the important thing is that this parameter epsilon, this is an unphysical parameter which appears in these Pollorino-Wellman functions. So we have to take this parameter equals to zero, except one over epsilon, because it will give divergences. So now the problem is how to remove this one over epsilon or the divergent terms. So this method is known as the renormalization method. And there are several renormalization schemes which you can use to remove these divergent quantities from your expression. So I use the most simplest one, which is the MSBAR scheme. So in this scheme, I just simply remove this parameter, the divergent parameter from my expression. And in this way, my expression becomes non-divergent. And at three level, the electric charge is simply equals to alpha times 4 pi. Alpha is the fine structure constant. But as you include more higher order loops, you will see that this electric charge does not remain constant, but it depends upon the parameter of the scheme. So here, this is the formula for the effective fine structure constant. In denominator, you have this photon vacuum polarization expression. And when you substitute it, you will see that here's the graph. So this is the graph when I choose my parameter mu to be the momentum transfer k, and on y-axis, we have this running of fine structure constant. And as you can see, when the momentum transfer is large, this fine structure constant also increases. And here, these are the resonances, which are known as the production resonances. And they basically represent the production of those particles which are present inside our photon loops. So that's all about the running of the fine structure constant. And now our next goal is to perform the complete one loop level calculations for molar parity violating asymmetry using the MS-bar scheme. And then we want to determine the running of electroweak charge to get more precise value of that Weinberg mixing angle. And the consistency of these results can enable us to search for the signals of physics beyond the standard model. Then thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. And questions for Mahoon? I don't see any questions. There will be plenty more. And so we should thank Mahoon again for the wonderful talk.
Thank you so much.
We will next hear from Sharmila Gunasekaran, also from Memorial University.
Yeah, I'll start by thanking the organizers for a chance to speak in this wonderful conference. What I'll be talking about is joint work with my PhD supervisor, Hari Kanduri. I just graduated and right now I'm a postdoctoral fellow with the Department of Mathematical Sciences at the University of Alberta. Sorry, I'm having trouble transitioning to the next slide. The subject of this talk is the quantitative behavior of solutions to the massless scalar wave equation in the background of a fixed space-time. And the fixed space-time here is a family of gravitational solitons. So a rough outline for the talk is I'll first discuss what we are studying, which is the space-time of the interest and the wave equation. And second, I'll move on to some motivation for why we are studying the space-time and why the stability question is actually relevant. And I'll finish with a rough sketch of the proof used to prove that waves in these spacetimes decay very slowly, and very slowly because the decay is inverse logarithmic in time as opposed to inverse polynomial in time. Gravitational solitons are smooth, globally stationary, asymptotically flat spacetimes with positive energy. More contrastingly put, these are non-black hole solutions. They don't have a horizon, but the spacetimes are not trivial. We still have a positive mass. Now, Einstein-Maxwell theories in four dimensions don't admit such solutions. This result was proved by Lechnarowicz way back in the 1950s. And one can even prove that one cannot have such solutions in higher dimensional static Einstein-Maxwell theories. And the family that we are looking at belongs to a 5D supergravity theory whose action is given by equation one. This is the usual Einstein electrovac bit. And here you can see that there is a nonlinear term called a Chern-Simons term, which actually sources the Maxwell field. So the Maxwell field is self-sourced and that's what gives rise to the mass and the charge for the soliton spacetimes. The symmetries in this spacetimes are R times SU times times U1. And the spatial slices have the topology of CP2 with a point removed. Now, we study the wave equation in this family of spacetimes with the understanding that this scalar wave actually is a perturbation. And in the context of the initial value problem, we see that this perturbation is looked at as an initial data. And what we would like to understand is the evolution of phi. That is, how does phi behave as we evolve in time? And from a PD perspective, precisely, we ask if the L2 energy at a future is bounded by the initial L2 energy. And if there is boundedness, then we ask, okay, this is a perturbation. So do we actually expect a decay of perturbations? Now, the motivation for studying soliton spacetimes from a string theory perspective is that they have a microstate interpretation. So these solitons are interpreted as alternate states for black holes with similar charge and similar mass. And why do we study the wave equation? Now, let's just look at the Einstein equations. We know that the Ricci tensor has the following dependence on the metric. And in wave gate, say in vacuum, one can write down the equations in this form. So these are a bunch of coupled quasi-linear wave equations. So to start studying perturbation theory, the simplest equation you can actually consider is the equation for a single scalar field in the background of a fixed spacetime. And once that is done, we can then go ahead and introduce nonlinearities and see how the system changes. Right. There are several geometric obstructions that come into play when one studies waves in spacetimes. There is the redshift effect, which is in a Schwarzschild spacetime, and there's super radiance, which is in Kerr spacetimes. But the spacetime that we have does not have a horizon or a black hole. So none of that is an issue. But instead, what we have is the trapping of null geodesics. Trapping is roughly the confinement of geodesics. And if one takes the example of the Schwarzschild spacetime, this happens in the R is equal to 3M surface. But this structure of trapping is unstable. That is to say, if I slightly perturb this, then the geodesics which are initially trapped are no longer trapped. But the kind of trapping we see in the soliton spacetimes that we look at is stable. So there's an open set of geodesics which are trapped. And even if I slightly perturb this structure, there is going to be an open set of geodesics which are still trapped. And so this stable trapping slows down the decay of waves from something like an inverse polynomial decay to a logarithmic decay. This is also something that's been observed in Kerr ADS spacetimes, which was worked out by Holzegel and Smulwicki. And it has been worked out in higher dimensional solitons by Kerr and in black rings by Binomio. So I'll stop here with a sketch of the proof of slow decay. Now, how do geodesics really relate to waves? From the iconal approximation, we expect that waves roughly travel along null geodesics. So if there's a confinement of null geodesics, then there is a confinement of waves as well. So there are time periodic bound state solutions, because if we have a potential like this, one can roughly work out that there have to be bound state solutions. These can be extended to the whole spacetime with a very small error induced in this extension. And the existence of such solutions provides a proof for logarithmic decay. And so this is the main result. And I'll stop by saying that this technique can be used to probe the decay of other configurations, like a black hole soliton configurations as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Sharmila, her wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Okay, I know there, Anne has a question. Also, Sumatsi.
Yes, you said at the beginning that there are no solitons or gravitational solitons in four dimensions. Did I understand correctly?
Yes.
Can you tell me the reason, because I missed that?
Okay, so this was a result proved by Lechnerowicz. And so one can see that roughly from the positive mass theorem. So one can show that unless you have a boundary, the mass, the expression for mass that comes from the Komar integral actually vanishes. And if that vanishes, then the only spacetime that you can have is Minkowski, because the positive mass theorem also has a rigidity statement along with it.
Okay.
That's roughly the reason.
Okay, so in which dimensions does it work then, apart from four dimensions?
Oh, this is only in four dimensions. And in so in four dimensions, there's also the result that the domain of outer communications has to be simply connected. So this is restricted to four dimensions, and the solutions I'm looking at are in five dimensions.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Sumati.
Yeah, thanks for a really nice talk. You mentioned microstates. I'm curious, you know, in terms of the black hole thermodynamics, that the results in from string theory or deep brain physics, is there a relationship between what you're doing? And I wasn't able to see any connection there, but you did mention microstates. So I was curious about that.
I did mention microstates. So these solutions were originally studied with the motivation that they would provide an explanation for the black hole entropy. Now, I'm not very familiar with the string theory side of the calculations, but that was one of the motivations for studying them. And I think it also goes by the name of the fuzzball conjecture, if you're familiar with it. But I haven't done any calculations in my work relating to that. This is a purely classical result. I think we can discuss more probably. I'll read up on that and we can probably discuss more about that.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
So if there are no further questions, I think we should thank Jamila again for a lovely talk. And our next speaker is Lisa Glasser.
In the stuff I got sent out, I was told to introduce myself, which explains my first slide. So in case you didn't listen when I introduced myself yesterday, but I'm a postdoc in Vienna right now. I work on causal set theory and non-commutative geometry and have a bit of a dirty past in causal dynamical triangulations, one could say. And using the opportunity to advertise, I'm a co-organizer of the Quantum Gravity Across Approaches seminar, where we are just about to finish our first series about observables. The talks are all online. Kasia and Renate have given wonderful talks, and there will be a panel discussion end of March, early April. So today I want to tell you a little bit about computer simulations on spectral triples. Now, let me begin with what do I want to do? Why do I want to do that? So quantum gravity on the computer. My recipe for this is pretty simple and universal. Define your theory, pick your observables, choose your algorithm. So to define your theory, you need to have your geometries, could be causal sets, or today it's going to be Dirac operators, and then a measure on the space of Dirac operators. I'll need some functions of the geometry, which I can measure. In this case, mostly eigenvalues. And I need an action as the energy in the measure. Not an action in the sense of algebra action for mathematicians, but really a physicist's action. I want to do that with spectral triples. So here's a quick introduction to spectral triples. These are slides meant for physicists. So the mathematicians are probably going to miss some details that I could have had in the other version. Anyways, a spectral triple consists of an algebra that acts on a Hilbert space and a Dirac operator. The motivation, if we want to go very simple, is that just knowing the eigenvalues, the spectrum of the Dirac operator, doesn't tell us everything about the geometry. Instead, we also need to know the algebra. In general, if we're just using a spectral triple to describe a smooth geometry, then the algebra will be commutative, but we're allowed to just take more general algebras and make it non-commutative. The conditions that we need the algebra to satisfy, and the Hilbert space and the Dirac operator, they are long, but in principle, we need two things. H needs to be a bimodule over the algebra, so we have actions of the algebra on the Hilbert space from the left and the right, and the first order condition. So Dirac operator with one algebra element commutes with another algebra element. This basically means the Dirac operator is a first order differential operator on our geometry. Now, if we take a spectral triple like that, we can recover the distance. So in a spectral triple, we can define a distance between states just as the supremum over all functions with the supremum over all algebra elements, where we take the absolute value of the difference between the states acting on the algebra elements with, for all algebra elements that have commutator less than one with the Dirac operator. That sounds complicated, but we can think about it easily enough if we have just a simple function. So we want to know the distance between x and y. Well, the distance between x and y is actually also the difference of the function value at x and the function value at y for the function, just the function is equal to the coordinate. And basically, the definition above generalizes this. Now, in the work that I wanted to very quickly introduce today, we had this idea, hey, let's use the distance to make a plot of a spectral triple. We had generated truncated spectral triples and we were wondering what those were doing because they were not all definitely a sphere, but something else. So maybe we could see that. What we need to do if we want to do that is we need states of small dispersion, and then we need to know the distance between these states and build a picture of the manifold. For that, we need to define which algebra elements we want to optimize over and which states we want to use, which we do. We use coherent states, and then we get a picture. And this is a picture of really just a sphere. We've also done it for our weirder, more complicated geometry. It still works, but it's not that interesting, and I didn't want to explain the whole what the other geometry is, but we can make pictures of spectral triples, and if you give me your favorite spectral triple, I can sit down and try and make a picture of that. Disclaimer, it's probably not going to work very well. I'm still trying to figure out how to make it work for more general spectral triples. And on my last plan, what are my future plans? Well, as I said, I want to do it to more spectral triples. I actually have a bunch of other geometries that I want to have pictures of, and I'm working on extending the algorithm when I have time. Use different visualizations. As I was just saying, it's not working very well for most things. One of the reasons is because we picked certain class of algebra elements, so we need to generalize that. Use the algorithm on other spectral triples. And also another thing that I want to work on is using spectral triples actually as meta for other quantum gravity approaches, for example, spectral triples as meta in causal sets. And that's the talk. Thank you.
Wonderful talk. Questions for Lisa? Kasia has a question.
So I have a silly question. Can you make a picture of the spectral triple that Roberta was talking about? I mean, like this, so the idea of these VV spectral triples, and VV is very close to my heart. So, I mean, I'm kind of complicated, but it would be great.
I'm happy to try. We'd have to sit down and you'd have to actually explain better to me what these BV spectral triples are. Also, I think it'll work better for the geometric ones. I'm not sure how matter would show up in what I'm doing here, but always worth a try. If okay. I can't make a picture of it, I can probably tell you the dimension of it and I can calculate the distance to arbitrary other spectral triples.
Just putting it up. Thank
I've
you.
Got some tools. Come talk to me.
Sumati.
Yes, Lisa, thanks for a really nice talk. And I'm sure you didn't mean CDTs as your dirty past. I saw Renata startle at that. You must mean something else. but aside, I'm sure you meant something else. But just your last slide. do you have a sense at all? I mean, you know, non-commutative geometry in some sense is close to posets. It can arise from posets and it's a very natural way of thinking about it. But in causal sets, it would, you know, the issue comes down to always this Lorentzian structure, this damn Lorentzian structure. Do you have any sense of what these might be? How to do matter with this?
So my immediate plan is to be relatively naive and just really add extra structure to the causal set as a first start. But then the second start is there are spectral triples for simple for graphs. And I'm hoping to generalize from that and then maybe write a spectral triple for a causal set and see where that leads me. And of course, I mean, well, I guess I said dirty past because that's the kind of phrasing. I don't know.
We're just kidding. I think we're just kidding.
I'm too tired. But, past dinner time.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sorry. Yes, sorry, Renata, I didn't mean to.
So let's thank Lisa again for the wonderful talk. And